Chapter 17. Endocrine and Hematologic Emergencies. Introduction. The endocrine system directly or indirectly influences almost every cell, organ, and function of the body. Consequently, patients with an endocrine disorder often are seen with a multitude of signs and symptoms that require a thorough assessment and immediate treatment. This chapter also discusses hematologic emergencies, which rarely occur in most EMS systems. Although hematologic disorders can be difficult to assess and treat in a pre-hospital setting, your actions may not only offer support, but you may save the patient's life. Anatomy and physiology. The endocrine system is a complex message and control system that includes a network of glands that produce and secrete messengers called hormones. Endocrine glands, endo means inside, secrete or release chemicals that are used inside the body. A hormone is a chemical substance produced by a gland that has special regulatory effects on other organs and tissues. The main function of the endocrine system and its hormone messengers is to maintain homeostasis, which is stability in the body's internal environment. For example, maintaining homeostasis requires a response to any change in the body, such as low glucose or calcium levels in the blood. Endocrine disorders can be caused by either hypersecretion, overproduction, or hyposecretion, underproduction of a gland. Pathophysiology. Diabetes is a common disease affecting about 7% of the population. Diabetes is a metabolic disorder that involves abnormalities in the body's ability to use glucose, sugar. Consequently, the body is unable to control the level of glucose in the blood. Without treatment, blood glucose levels become too high, which can cause coma and death. If properly treated, most people with diabetes can live a relatively normal life. However, diabetes can have severe complications, including blindness, cardiovascular disease, and kidney failure that affect the length and quality of life. Also, the treatment to lower high blood glucose levels can exceed the patient's need and cause a life-threatening state of hypoglycemia, low blood glucose. Therefore, as an EMT, you need to know the signs and symptoms of a blood glucose level that is either too high or too low, so you can administer the proper life-saving treatment. The two types of diabetes are discussed, as well as how they are controlled, including the role of glucose and insulin. You will learn how to distinguish between hyperglycemia and hypoglycemia, conditions that have signs and symptoms that often resemble each other. Complications related to diabetes, such as seizures and altered mental status, are also briefly discussed. Diabetes. The word diabetes literally means a passer-through, a siphon. Medically, the term refers to a metabolic disorder in which the body's ability to metabolize simple carbohydrates, glucose, is impaired. Glucose, or dextrose, is one of the basic sugars used in the body, and in conjunction with oxygen, is the primary fuel for cellular metabolism. In a person with diabetes, signs and symptoms include significant thirst, passage of large quantities of urine containing glucose, and deterioration of body functions. The central problem in diabetes is the lack or ineffective action of insulin, a hormone that is normally produced by the endocrine glands on the pancreas that enables glucose to enter the cells. Without insulin, cells begin to starve because insulin is needed, like a key, to allow glucose into the cells. The full name of diabetes is diabetes mellitus, which means sweet diabetes. This refers to the presence of glucose, sugar, in the urine. Diabetes mellitus is a metabolic disorder in which the body cannot metabolize glucose, usually because of the lack of insulin. The result is a wasting of glucose in the urine. Diabetes insipidus, a rare condition, also involves excessive urination, but here the missing hormone is one that regulates urinary fluid reabsorption. In this text, the term diabetes always refers to diabetes mellitus. Left untreated, diabetes leads to a wasting of body tissues and death. Even with medical care, some patients with particularly aggressive forms of diabetes will die relatively young of one or more complications of the disease. Most patients with diabetes, however, live a normal lifespan, but they must be willing to adjust their lives, especially their eating habits and activities, to the demands of the disease. Types of diabetes. Diabetes is a disease with two distinct onset patterns. It may become evident when the patient is a child, or it may develop in later life, usually when the patient is middle-aged. In type 1 diabetes, patients do not produce insulin. They need daily injections of supplemental synthetic insulin to control their levels of blood glucose. This type of diabetes typically develops during childhood. Because of this, in the past, it was called juvenile onset diabetes, or insulin-dependent diabetes mellitus, IDDM. However, type 1 diabetes can, in many cases, develop in later life as well. Patients with type 1 diabetes are more likely to have metabolic problems and organ damage, such as blindness, heart disease, kidney failure, and nerve disorders. In type 2 diabetes, which usually appears later in life, patients produce inadequate amounts of insulin, or they may produce a normal amount, but the insulin does not function effectively. Although some patients with type 2 diabetes may require supplemental insulin, many patients can be treated with diet, exercise, and non-insulin-type oral medications, hypoglycemic agents, such as chlorpropamide, diabenase, tolbutamide, oranase, gliburide, micronase, glipizide, glucotrol, metformin, glucophage, and rosiglitazone, Avandia. These medications stimulate the pancreas to produce more insulin and thus lower blood glucose levels. In some patients, these medications can lead to hypoglycemia, an abnormally low level of blood glucose, particularly when patient activity and exercise levels are too vigorous or excessive. In the past, type 2 diabetes was called non-insulin-dependent diabetes mellitus, NIDDM, or adult maturity onset diabetes. Again, some patients with type 2 diabetes may, in fact, require insulin. The two types of diabetes are equally serious, although type 2 diabetes is often easier to regulate. Both can affect many tissues and functions other than those of the glucose-regulating mechanism. Both require lifelong medical management. Type 1 diabetes is considered an autoimmune problem in which the body becomes allergic to and therefore destroys the insulin-producing cells of the endocrine glands in the pancreas. The severity of diabetic complications is related to how high the average blood glucose level is and how early in life the diabetes begins. Type 2 diabetes is much more common than type 1 diabetes and is becoming more prevalent in today's society. Obesity is one risk factor that has become more frequent in the population. The role of glucose and insulin. Glucose is the major source of energy for the body. All cells need glucose to function properly, and some cells will even cease to function without it. Having a constant supply of glucose is as important as having a constant supply of oxygen to the brain. Without glucose, or with very low levels, brain cells rapidly suffer permanent damage. As stated earlier, insulin is needed to allow glucose to enter individual cells, with the exception of brain cells, to fuel their functions. For this reason, insulin is said to be a cellular key. Without insulin, glucose from food remains in the blood and the levels gradually become extremely high. This condition is called hyperglycemia. Once the blood glucose level reaches 200 milligrams per deciliter or more, or twice the usual amount, normal is 80 to 120 milligrams per deciliter, excess glucose is excreted by the kidney. This process requires a large amount of water. The loss of water in such large amounts causes the classic symptoms of uncontrolled diabetes, the three P's: polyuria, frequent and plentiful urination; polydipsia, frequent drinking of liquid to satisfy continuous thirst following the loss of excessive amounts of body water; polyphagia, excessive eating as a result of cellular hunger seen only occasionally. Without glucose to supply energy for cells, the body must turn to other fuel sources. The most abundant source is fat. Unfortunately, when fat is used as an immediate energy source, chemicals called ketones and fatty acids are formed as waste products and are hard for the body to excrete. As they accumulate in blood and tissue, certain ketones can produce a dangerous condition called acidosis. The form of acidosis seen in uncontrolled diabetes is called diabetic ketoacidosis, DKA, in which an accumulation of certain acids occurs when insulin is not available in the body. DKA is considered to be a type of hyperglycemic crisis. DKA is more commonly found in type 1 diabetes because the body does not produce any insulin. Signs and symptoms of DKA include weakness, nausea, vomiting, abdominal pain, a weak and rapid pulse, and a type of deep, rapid breathing called Kussmaul respirations. These respirations help the body blow off excess acids. Diabetics suffering from DKA may have an altered mental status and may have a sweet smell to their breath caused by the ketones. When the acid levels in the body become too high, individual cells will cease to function. If the patient is not given proper fluid and insulin to reverse fat metabolism and restore the use of glucose as a source of energy, ketoacidosis will progress to unconsciousness, hyperglycemic crisis, and eventually death. Type 2 diabetes more often results in HHNC, hyperosmolar hyperglycemic non-ketotic coma. The onset of HHNC is typically slower and occurs over a longer period than DKA. The sweet smell is not present on the breath. Because the body is producing some insulin, the body does not burn fat for energy. Therefore, ketones are not produced. The body tries to get rid of the excess sugar in the urine. The fluid follows the sugar, causing dehydration. As we have seen, diabetes mellitus is treatable. However, treatment must be tailored for the individual patient. The patient's need for glucose must be balanced with the available supply of insulin by testing either the blood or urine. Most type 1 diabetic patients monitor their blood glucose levels several times a day with a glucometer, a credit card-sized device. A drop of blood, usually from the fingertip, is touched to a disposable sensor and read by the device. The readings are in milligrams per deciliter of blood. Remember that the normal blood glucose level is between 80 and 120 milligrams per deciliter. Among the new measuring devices under development is one that is worn like a wristwatch or used like a pulse oximeter. Currently, EMTs are allowed to use glucometers in some systems across North America. However, glucose test strips, in which a drop of blood is placed on a paper strip that changes color, may still be used in some systems. Test strips do not provide the accuracy of glucometers, and their readings should be used with caution. Hyperglycemia and hypoglycemia. Two conditions can lead to a diabetic emergency: hyperglycemia and hypoglycemia. Hyperglycemia is a state in which the blood glucose level is above normal. Hypoglycemia is a state in which the blood glucose level is below normal. Extremes of hyperglycemia and hypoglycemia can lead to diabetic emergencies. Prolonged hyperglycemia with exceptionally high glucose levels results in diabetic ketoacidosis, a type of hyperglycemic crisis. Hypoglycemia, on the other hand, will progress to unresponsiveness and eventually hypoglycemic crisis. The signs and symptoms of hyperglycemia and hypoglycemia can be quite similar. For example, staggering and an intoxicated appearance or complete unresponsiveness are signs and symptoms of both. Note that your assessment of these potential emergencies should not prevent you from providing prompt care and transport as detailed in this chapter. However, in such urgent emergencies, the earlier clues are gathered, the better for the patient. With specific information about the type of emergency that is presenting, you can help the hospital to prepare prompt, definitive care for the patient. Hyperglycemic crisis, diabetic coma. Hyperglycemic crisis is a state of unconsciousness resulting from several problems, including ketoacidosis, hyperglycemia, and dehydration resulting from excessive urination. Too much blood glucose by itself does not always cause a hyperglycemic crisis, but on some occasions, excess blood glucose can lead to it. A hyperglycemic crisis may occur in a patient who is not under medical treatment, who takes an insufficient amount of insulin, who markedly overeats, or who is undergoing some sort of stress that may involve an infection, illness, overexertion, fatigue, or drinking alcohol. Usually, ketoacidosis develops over a period of time, from hours to days. The patient may ultimately be found with the following physical signs: Kussmaul respirations, rapid, deep respirations, dehydration, as indicated by dry, warm, tenting skin and sunken eyes, a sweet or fruity acetone odor on the breath caused by the unusual waste products in the blood, ketones, a rapid, weak, thready pulse, a normal or slightly low blood pressure, varying degrees of unresponsiveness, weakness, nausea, and vomiting, polyuria, excessive urination, polydipsia, excessive thirst, polyphagia, excessive eating. Hypoglycemic crisis, insulin shock. In a hypoglycemic crisis, also known as insulin shock, when it occurs in patients taking supplemental insulin or medications that stimulate the pancreas to produce more insulin, the problem is hypoglycemia, or insufficient levels of glucose in the blood. When insulin levels remain high, glucose is rapidly taken out of the blood to fuel the cells. If glucose levels fall too low, there may be an insufficient amount to supply the brain. The mental status of the patient declines, hypoglycemic crisis, and he or she may become aggressive or display unusual behavior. If blood glucose remains low, unconsciousness and permanent brain damage can quickly follow. A hypoglycemic crisis occurs when the patient has done one of the following: taken too much insulin, taken a regular dose of insulin but has not eaten enough food, had an unusual amount of activity or vigorous exercise, and used up all available glucose. A hypoglycemic crisis may also occur after the patient vomits a meal, after he or she took a regular dose of insulin. At times, hypoglycemia may occur with no identifiable predisposing factor. Children who have diabetes may pose a particular management problem. First, their high levels of activity mean that they can use up circulating glucose more quickly than adults do, even after a normal insulin injection. Second, they do not always eat correctly and on schedule. As a result, a hypoglycemic crisis can develop more often and more severely in children than in adults. Hypoglycemia develops much more quickly than hyperglycemia. In some instances, it can occur in a matter of minutes. Hypoglycemia can be associated with the following signs and symptoms: normal to shallow or rapid respirations, pale, moist, clammy skin, diaphoresis, sweating, dizziness, headache, rapid pulse, normal to low blood pressure, altered mental status, aggressive, confused, lethargic, or unusual behavior, anxious or combative behavior, hunger, seizure, fainting, or coma, weakness on one side of the body, may mimic stroke, rapid changes in mental status. Both extremes of hyperglycemia and hypoglycemia produce unconsciousness and, in some instances, death. But they call for very different treatment. Hyperglycemia is a complex metabolic condition that usually develops over time and involves all the tissues of the body. Correcting this condition may take many hours in a well-controlled hospital setting. Hypoglycemia, however, is an acute condition that can develop rapidly. A patient with diabetes who has taken his or her standard insulin dose and missed lunch may have a hypoglycemic crisis before dinner. The condition is just as quickly reversed by giving the patient glucose. Without the glucose, however, the patient can suffer permanent brain damage. Minutes count. Although most individuals with diabetes understand and manage their disease well, emergencies can occur. In addition to hyperglycemic and hypoglycemic crises, patients with diabetes may have silent or painless heart attacks, a possibility that you should always consider. Their only symptom may be not feeling so well. Patient assessment of diabetes. Scene size up. Scene safety. Evaluate scene safety as you arrive on scene and as you approach the patient. Make sure that all hazards are addressed. Remember that diabetic patients often use syringes to administer insulin. It is possible you may be stuck by a used needle that was not disposed of properly. Insulin syringes on the bedstand, insulin bottles in the refrigerator, a plate of food, or glass of orange juice are important clues that may help you decide what is possibly wrong with your patient. Evaluate each situation quickly and make sure the necessary personal protective equipment is readily available. Standard precautions should consist of gloves and eye protection at a minimum. As you approach, question bystanders on events leading to your arrival. Determine whether this is your only patient and whether trauma was involved. Decide whether you will need any additional resources. Mechanism of injury, nature of illness. Although your report from dispatch may be for a patient with an altered mental status, keep open the possibility that trauma may have occurred because of a medical incident. Determine mechanism of injury and/or nature of illness. Do not let your guard down even on what appears to be a routine call. Primary assessment. Form a general impression. Perform a rapid scan of the patient in order to form a general impression of the patient. How does the patient look? Does he or she appear anxious, restless, or listless? Is the patient apathetic or irritable? Is the patient interacting with his or her environment appropriately? These initial observations may lead you to suspect high or low blood glucose values. Identify life threats and provide life-saving interventions, particularly airway management. Determine the patient's level of consciousness using the AVPU, alert to person, place, and day, responsive to verbal stimuli, responsive to pain, unresponsive scale. If a suspected diabetic patient is unresponsive, call for advanced life support, ALS, immediately. An unconscious patient may have undiagnosed diabetes. In patients with an altered mental status, you may be able to determine whether diabetes is present in the field by assessing the patient's blood glucose level if you have the proper equipment and training. Perform cervical spine stabilization when necessary and provide rapid transport. At the emergency department, diabetes and its complications can be quickly diagnosed. Remember that even though a person has diabetes, the diabetes may not be causing the current problem. Heart attack, stroke, or another medical emergency may be the cause. For this reason, you must always carry out a thorough, careful primary assessment, paying attention to the ABCs. Airway and breathing. As you are forming your general impression, assess the patient's airway and breathing. Patients showing signs of inadequate breathing or altered mental status should receive high-flow oxygen at 12 to 15 liters per minute via non-rebreathing mask. A patient who is hyperglycemic may have rapid, deep respirations, Kussmaul respirations, and sweet, fruity breath. A patient who is hypoglycemic will have normal or shallow to rapid respirations. If the patient is not breathing or is having difficulty breathing, open the airway and insert an airway adjunct, administer oxygen, and assist ventilations. Continue to monitor the airway as you provide care. Circulation. Once you have assessed airway and breathing and have performed the necessary life-saving interventions, check the patient's circulatory status. A patient with dry and warm skin indicates hyperglycemia, whereas a patient with moist and pale skin indicates hypoglycemia. The patient in hypoglycemic crisis will have a rapid, weak pulse. Transport decision. Whether you decide to transport at this stage of the assessment will depend on the patient's level of consciousness and the ability to swallow. Patients with an altered mental status and impaired ability to swallow should be transported promptly. Patients who have the ability to swallow and are conscious enough to maintain their own airway may be further evaluated on scene and interventions performed. History taking. Investigate chief complaint. Investigate the chief complaint or the history of the present illness. Responsive patients usually are able to provide their own medical history. If the patient has eaten but has not taken insulin, it is more likely that hyperglycemia is developing. If the patient has taken insulin but has not eaten, the problem is more likely to be hypoglycemia. A patient with diabetes will often know what is wrong. If the patient is not thinking or speaking clearly or is unconscious, ask a family member or a bystander the same questions. Physical signs such as tremors, abdominal cramps, vomiting, a fruity breath odor, or a dry mouth may guide you in determining whether the patient is hypoglycemic or hyperglycemic. Sample history. You will need to obtain a sample history from your patient. In addition, be sure to ask the following questions of a known diabetic patient. Do you take insulin or any pills that lower your blood sugar? Have you taken your usual dose of insulin or pills today? Have you eaten normally today? Have you had any illness, unusual amount of activity, or stress? When you are assessing a patient who might have diabetes, check to see whether he or she has an emergency medical identification device, a wallet card, necklace, or bracelet, or ask the patient or a family member. Remember that the environment, bystanders, and medical identification devices may provide important clues about your patient's condition. Secondary assessment. In some instances where the patient is critically ill or injured or the transport time is short, you may not have time to conduct a secondary assessment. In other instances, the secondary assessment may occur on scene or en route to the emergency department. Physical examinations. First, assess unresponsive patients from head to toe with a full body scan, looking for clues to their condition. The patient may have experienced trauma resulting from dizziness or from changes in level of consciousness. Next, reassess the patient's vital signs. As in every call, you should perform a secondary assessment when time permits. With unconscious patients or patients with an altered mental status, you must assume the role of detective and look for problems or injuries that are not obvious because the patient is unable to communicate these to you. Although an altered mental status may be caused by a blood glucose level that is too high or too low, the patient may have sustained trauma or have another metabolic problem. An altered mental status may also be caused by something else, such as intoxication, poisoning, or a head injury. A systematic examination of the patient may provide you with information essential to proper patient care. When you suspect a diabetes-related problem, a secondary assessment should focus on the patient's mental status, an ability to swallow, and protect the airway. Obtain a Glasgow Coma Scale score to track the patient's neurologic status. Vital signs. Obtain a complete set of vital signs, including a measurement of the patient's blood glucose level using a glucometer, if available, and local protocols allow. In hypoglycemia, respirations are normal to rapid, pulse is weak and rapid, and skin is typically pale and clammy with a low blood pressure. In hyperglycemia, respirations are deep and rapid, pulse is rapid, weak, and thready, and skin is warm and dry with a normal blood pressure. At times, the blood pressure may be low. It should be easier for you to identify abnormal vital signs when you know the blood glucose level is too high or too low. Remember, the patient may have abnormal vital signs and a normal blood glucose value. When this is the case, something else may be causing the patient's altered mental status, vomiting, or other complaints. Monitoring devices. Because hyperglycemia or hypoglycemia may be the cause of your patient's decreased level of consciousness, it is important to obtain your patient's blood glucose level using a monitoring device, if protocols allow. Most commonly, this is accomplished via a portable blood glucose monitor, glucometer, similar to the one your patient may use at home. The portable blood glucose monitor measures the glucose level in whole blood using either capillary or venous samples. It is important to read and understand the operator's manual before use because the specifications of the device may vary depending on the manufacturer. Some glucometers indicate low, low when they detect a glucose reading of less than 20 milligrams per deciliter, whereas others display low when they detect a reading less than 30 milligrams per deciliter. Conversely, the same is true with a high, high reading. Some glucometers read high at 550 milligrams per deciliter and some at 600 milligrams per deciliter. Therefore, it is important to know both the upper and lower ranges at which your glucometer functions. The normal range for glucose levels in blood in non-fasting adults and children is 80 to 120 milligrams per deciliter. The blood glucose level in neonates should be above 70 milligrams per deciliter. In a patient experiencing a diabetic emergency, a pulse oximeter is a useful device that will assist you in assessing the patient's perfusion status. By using pulse oximetry, you will be able to determine the percentage of oxygen saturation in the bloodstream, which will assist in identifying the patient's degree of respiratory distress. However, remember that pulse oximetry is just another tool in the EMT's toolbox. The decision to apply oxygen to a patient experiencing a diabetic emergency should be based on a careful assessment of the patient's airway and breathing, not solely on pulse oximetry readings. Reassessment. It is important to reassess the diabetic patient frequently to assess changes. Is there an improvement in the patient's mental status? Are the ABCs still intact? How is the patient responding to the interventions performed? How must you adjust or change the interventions? In many patients with diabetes, you will note marked improvement with appropriate treatment. Document each assessment, your findings, the time of the interventions, and any changes in the patient's condition. Base your administration of glucose on serial readings if you have access to a glucometer. If a glucometer is unavailable, a deteriorating level of consciousness indicates that you need to provide more glucose. Again, the use of glucometers and the administration of glucose will be based on your service's protocols and standing orders. Interventions. If your patient is hypoglycemic, conscious, and able to swallow without the risk of aspiration, you should encourage him or her to drink juice or other drinks that contain sugar. Do not be afraid to give too much sugar. Do not give sugar-free drinks that are sweetened with saccharin or other synthetic sweetening compounds, as they will have little or no effect. If you are permitted by local protocol, you may also administer a highly concentrated sugar gel, such as oral glucose or intramuscular, IM, glucagon, which is squirted between the patient's cheek and gums or placed between the cheek and gum on a tongue depressor. The patient will usually become more alert within minutes. Remember that even when the patient responds after receiving glucose, he or she may still need additional treatment. Therefore, you must transport the patient to the hospital as soon as possible. If your hypoglycemic patient is unconscious or if there is any risk of aspiration, the patient will need intravenous IV glucose or intramuscular IM glucagon, which you are not authorized to give. Your responsibility is to provide prompt transport to the hospital, where the proper care can be given. If you are working in a tiered system, AEMTs and paramedics are able to start an IV line and administer IV glucose. If no one else is present and you know that the unconscious patient has diabetes, you must use your knowledge of the signs and symptoms to decide whether the problem is hypoglycemia or hyperglycemia. Remember, however, this assessment should not prevent you from providing prompt treatment and transport. The primary visible difference will be the patient's breathing, deep sighing respirations in hyperglycemia, and normal or rapid respirations in hypoglycemia. The patient with diabetes who is unconscious and having seizures is more likely to be in a hypoglycemic crisis. A patient in hypoglycemic crisis, rapid onset of altered mental status, hypoglycemia, needs sugar immediately. A patient in hyperglycemic crisis, acidosis, dehydration, hyperglycemia, needs insulin and IV fluid therapy. These patients need prompt transport to the hospital for appropriate medical care. When there is any doubt about whether a conscious patient with diabetes is going into hypoglycemic or hyperglycemic crisis, most protocols will err on the side of giving glucose, even though the patient may have hyperglycemic or diabetic ketoacidosis. Untreated hypoglycemia will result in loss of consciousness and can quickly cause significant brain damage or death. The condition of a patient in hypoglycemic crisis is far more critical and far more likely to cause permanent problems compared with the condition of a patient with hyperglycemia or diabetic ketoacidosis. Furthermore, the amount of sugar that is typically given to a patient with hypoglycemic crisis is unlikely to make a patient in diabetic ketoacidosis significantly worse. When in doubt, consult medical control. Determining whether the blood glucose level is too high or too low in a known diabetic patient can be difficult when signs and symptoms are confusing and you have no way to test for a blood glucose value. In these situations, perform a thorough assessment and contact the hospital to help sort out the signs and symptoms. The hospital should be a resource for you to help problem-solve situations and provide guidance on how to manage your patient. Communication and documentation. Communication with hospital staff is important for continuity of care. Hospital personnel need to be informed about the patient's history, the present situation, your assessment findings, and your interventions and their results. Your run report is the only legal document you have to say that appropriate care was provided. Document clearly your assessment findings as the basis for your treatment. Patients who refuse transport because you cured them with oral glucose may require even more thorough documentation. Follow your local protocols for patients who refuse treatment or transport. Emergency medical care for diabetic emergencies. Giving oral glucose. Oral glucose is a commercially available gel that dissolves when placed in the mouth. One toothpaste type tube of gel equals 130-gram dose. Trade names for the gel include glutose and instaglucose. Glucose gel acts to increase a patient's blood glucose levels. If authorized by your system, you should administer glucose gel to any patient with a decreased level of consciousness who has a history of diabetes. The only contraindications to oral glucose are an inability to swallow and unconsciousness, because aspiration, inhalation of the substance, can occur. Oral glucose itself has no side effects if it is administered properly. However, the risk of aspiration in a patient who does not have a gag reflex is substantial. A conscious patient, even if confused, who does not really need glucose, will not be harmed by it. Therefore, do not hesitate to give glucose under these circumstances. As always, be sure to wear gloves before placing anything into a patient's mouth. After you have confirmed that the patient is conscious and able to swallow and have obtained an online or offline order, follow these steps to administer oral glucose. Skill Drill 17-1. 1. Examine the tube to ensure that it is not open or broken. Check the expiration date. 2. Squeeze a generous amount onto the bottom third of a bite stick or tongue depressor. 3. Open the patient's mouth. 4. Place the tongue depressor on the mucous membranes between the cheek and gum, with the gel side next to the cheek. Once the gel is dissolved, or if the patient loses consciousness or has a seizure, remove the tongue depressor. Repeat until the entire tube has been used. Note that the patient should not swallow the glucose. It acts more quickly when dissolved in the mouth. Reassess the patient's condition regularly after giving glucose, even if you see rapid improvement. Watch for airway problems, sudden loss of consciousness, or seizures. Provide prompt transport to the hospital. Do not delay transport just to give additional oral glucose. Problems associated with diabetes. Problems associated with diabetes include seizures, altered mental status, and airway problems. Remember to consider diabetic emergencies in patients who present with these emergencies. Seizures. Although seizures are rarely life-threatening, you should consider them to be very serious, even in patients with a history of chronic seizures. Seizures, which may be brief or prolonged, are caused by infections, poisoning, hypoglycemia, trauma, or decreased levels of oxygen. Or they may be idiopathic, of unknown cause. In children, they may be caused by fever or undiagnosed epilepsy. Although brief seizures are not harmful, they may indicate a more dangerous and potentially life-threatening underlying condition. Because seizures can be the result of a head injury, consider trauma as a cause. In the patient with diabetes, you should also consider hypoglycemia. Emergency medical care of seizures includes ensuring that the airway is clear and placing the patient on his or her side if there is no possibility of cervical spine trauma. Do not attempt to place anything in the patient's mouth, e.g. a bite stick or an oral airway. Be sure to have suctioning equipment ready in case the patient vomits. Provide oxygen or artificial ventilation if the patient is cyanotic or appears to be breathing inadequately, and provide prompt transport. Altered mental status. Although altered mental status is often caused by complications of diabetes, it may also be caused by a variety of other conditions, including poisoning, infection, head injury, part of the postictal state, period following a seizure, and decreased perfusion to the brain. In diabetes, altered mental status can be caused by hypoglycemia and by ketoacidosis. Begin emergency medical care of altered mental status by ensuring that the airway is clear. Be prepared to provide artificial ventilation and suctioning in case the patient vomits, and provide prompt transport. Alcoholism. Occasionally, patients with hypoglycemia or hyperglycemia are thought to be intoxicated, especially if their condition has caused a motor vehicle crash or other incident. Confined by police in a drunk tank, a patient with diabetes is at risk. In such situations, an emergency medical identification bracelet, necklace, or card may help to save the patient's life. Often, only a blood glucose test performed at the scene or in the emergency department will identify the real problem. In some EMS systems, you will be trained and allowed to perform the blood glucose testing at the scene. Otherwise, you must always suspect hypoglycemia in any patient with an altered mental status. Certainly, diabetes and alcoholism can coexist in a patient. But you must be alert to the similarity in symptoms of acute alcohol intoxication and diabetic emergencies. Likewise, hypoglycemia and a head injury can coexist, and you must appreciate the potential for hypoglycemia even when the head injury is obvious. Relationship to airway management. Patients with an altered mental status, particularly those who are difficult to awaken, are at risk for losing their gag reflex. When the gag reflex is not working, patients cannot expel foreign materials in their mouth, including vomit, and their tongues will often relax and obstruct the airway. Therefore, you must carefully monitor the airway in patients with hyperglycemia, hypoglycemia, or in a diabetic complication such as stroke or seizure. Place the patient in a lateral recumbent position and make sure suction is readily available. Hematologic emergencies. Hematology is the study and prevention of blood-related diseases such as sickle cell disease or hemophilia. To understand how hematologic disorders affect the body, the EMT must be familiar with the composition of blood. Blood is the fluid of life. Without it, people would not be able to live. Anatomy and physiology. Blood and plasma. Blood is made up of two main components, cells and plasma. Red blood cells, also known as erythrocytes, make up 47% of the blood volume in males and 42% in females. Within the red blood cells, hemoglobin is responsible for carrying oxygen to the tissues. White blood cells, also called leukocytes, are also found in the bloodstream. These cells are the cleaners of the body, traveling throughout in response to infection and dead cells. Platelets are small cells in the blood that are essential for clot formation. When damage occurs to a blood vessel, platelets are sent to the site of injury to assist in creating a blood clot to stop the bleeding. All of these components, red blood cells, white blood cells, and platelets, are suspended in a straw-colored fluid called plasma, which helps to transport cells throughout the body. Pathophysiology. Sickle cell disease. Sickle cell disease is an inherited blood disorder that affects the red blood cells. It is predominantly found in African Americans. The hemoglobin within the red blood cells allows the cells to carry oxygen from the lungs to the rest of the body. Normal red blood cells contain hemoglobin A. People who have sickle cell disease have an abnormal type of red blood cells that contains hemoglobin S. These red blood cells, instead of being the normal round shape, become oblong or sickle-shaped. This shape makes the red blood cells poor oxygen carriers, which means a patient with the disease may experience hypoxia or a lack of oxygen in the body's cells and tissues. The odd shape may also cause red blood cells to lodge in small blood vessels or in the spleen, causing the organ to swell and rupture, which can lead to death. Normally, red blood cells live for 120 days before they are replaced by new cells. Hemoglobin S cells live only 16 days. There are four main types of sickle cell crises. A vaso-occlusive crisis results from blood flow to an organ becoming restricted, causing pain, ischemia, and often organ damage. Most vaso-occlusive crises last between 5 and 7 days. Frequently, circulation to the spleen becomes obstructed as a result of its narrow vessels and function of removing damaged red blood cells. An aplastic crisis is a worsening of the patient's baseline anemia, lack of circulating red blood cells in the body, which causes tachycardia, pallor, and fatigue. This may be caused by the parvovirus B19, which affects the production of red blood cells, nearly stopping new production for 2 to 3 days. A hemolytic crisis is an acute accelerated drop in the patient's hemoglobin level. Caused by red blood cells breaking down at a faster than normal rate, this type of crisis is common in patients with glucose-6-phosphate dehydrogenase deficiency, a common enzyme deficiency. A splenic sequestration crisis is caused by painful acute enlargement of the spleen, causing the abdomen to become very hard and bloated. Complications of sickle cell disease. Patients with chronic sickle cell attacks are prone to severe, life-threatening complications of which the EMT must be aware. Although some of these complications take days to weeks to develop, some complications are acute and life-threatening. Some of the potential complications of sickle cell disease are as follows: cerebral vascular attack, gallstones, jaundice, avascular necrosis, splenic infections, osteomyelitis, opiate tolerance, leg ulcers, retinopathy, chronic pain, pulmonary hypertension, chronic renal failure. Clotting disorders. A clotting disorder is a condition in which there is an abnormality in clotting of the blood. The development of a blood clot is called thrombosis and can occur in either arterial or venous blood vessels. The patient's symptoms are related to the part of the vascular system in which the clot occurs, the size of the clot, and whether the clot becomes dislodged and travels to another part of the body. Thrombophilia. Thrombophilia, or the tendency to develop blood clots, affects a large number of people around the world and affects approximately 5% to 7% of the Caucasian population of European descent in the United States. Thrombosis is a common medical problem. Currently, an estimated 2 million people experience a deep venous thrombosis, or the formation of a clot in a deep vein, each year in the United States. In addition, nearly 50% of the patients experience long-term health consequences that adversely affect their quality of life and require millions of dollars of treatment. Thrombosis may manifest itself as the formation of a blood clot in a blood vessel or in one of the chambers of the heart. Deep venous thromboses are a leading cause of death in hospitalized patients. This form of clot develops for the first time in 200,000 to 300,000 patients annually during hospitalization because of their lack of mobility. Nearly 40% of the patients have a complication known as pulmonary embolism, a clot that travels to the lung and obstructs a significant amount of blood flow to the organ. Many patients with thrombophilia receive medications called blood thinners that decrease the tendency to form a clot. Examples of these medications include aspirin, heparin, and warfarin, Coumadin. Typically, pediatric patients do not experience blood clots. The following are some risk factors for increased clotting: recent surgery, impaired mobility, congestive heart failure, cancer, respiratory failure, infectious diseases, age older than 40 years, being overweight, obesity, smoking, oral contraceptive use. Hemophilia. Hemophilia is a genetic disorder that is usually inherited from the mother. In people with hemophilia, the body is not able to control bleeding by developing spontaneous clots as normal, resulting in an increased bleeding time. This condition occurs predominantly in males and occurs in approximately 1 in every 5,000 to 10,000 births. The disease is classified into two primary types. Hemophilia A. The most common type, hemophilia A, is due to low levels of factor VIII. Hemophilia B. This second most common type is associated with a deficiency of factor IX. The levels of factors 8 and 9 determine the severity of the disease. Both type A and type B have the same signs and symptoms. Acute and chronic bleeding can occur at any time and may or may not be life-threatening. Any injury or illness that can cause bleeding should not be taken lightly in a person with hemophilia. Spontaneous intracranial bleeding is common in hemophilia and is a major cause of death. Patient assessment of hematologic disorders. Scene size up. Scene safety. Although your report from dispatch may be for a patient with an unknown medical problem, most patients presenting with a sickle cell crisis have had a crisis before and will relay that information to the dispatcher. As you approach the scene, ensure your safety by assessing for hazards. Standard precautions should consist of gloves and eye protection at a minimum. Remember to evaluate each situation quickly and make sure the necessary personal protective equipment is readily available. Determine whether this is your only patient and whether trauma was involved. Decide whether you will need any additional resources. Patients experiencing a vaso-occlusive crisis are often in extreme pain and would benefit from ALS providers being able to administer analgesics. Mechanism of injury, nature of illness. Remember to keep open the possibility that trauma may have occurred because of a medical incident. Determine mechanism of injury and/or nature of illness. Primary assessment. An African-American patient or any patient of Mediterranean descent who complains of severe pain may have undiagnosed sickle cell disease. Perform cervical spine stabilization if necessary. Remember that even though a person has a history of sickle cell disease may not be causing the current problem. Trauma or another type of medical emergency may be the cause. For this reason, you must always perform a thorough, careful primary assessment, paying attention to the ABCs and immediately correcting any life-threatening issues. Form a general impression. Perform a rapid scan of the patient in order to form an initial general impression of the patient. How does the patient look? Does the patient appear anxious, restless, or listless? Is the patient apathetic or irritable? Determine the patient's level of consciousness. Airway and breathing. As you are forming your general impression, assess the patient's airway and breathing. Patients showing signs of inadequate breathing or altered mental status should receive high-flow oxygen at 12 to 15 liters per minute via non-rebreathing mask. A patient who is experiencing a sickle cell crisis may have increased respirations as a result of severe pain or exhibit signs of pneumonia. If the patient is having difficulty breathing, open the airway and insert an airway adjunct. Administer oxygen and assist ventilations. Continue to monitor the airway as you provide care. Circulation. Once you have assessed the airway and breathing and have performed the necessary interventions, check the patient's circulatory status. An increased heart rate represents a compensatory mechanism in an attempt to force the sickled cells through smaller vasculature. In patients with suspected hemophilia, be alert for signs of acute blood loss, such as pallor, weak pulse, and hypotension. Note any bleeding of unknown origin, such as nosebleeds, bloody sputum, and blood in the urine or stool. Owing to blood loss, patients with hemophilia may exhibit signs of hypoxia. Transport decision. Whether you decide to rapidly transport the patient will depend on the severity of the patient's pain and the patient's wishes. Patients with a history of sickle cell disease, but who have not had a crisis in some time, may require emotional support and refuse transport. However, transport to an emergency department should always be recommended to any patient who is experiencing a sickle cell crisis or hemophilia. History taking. Investigate chief complaint. If the patient is conscious, what is the chief complaint or history of present illness? Responsive medical patients are able to provide their own medical history to help you identify a cause for their severe pain. Physical signs, such as swelling of the fingers and toes, priapism, and jaundice, may guide you in determining whether the patient is experiencing a sickle cell crisis. Also important to ascertain is whether the pain is isolated to a single location or if the pain is felt throughout the entire body. Is the patient having any visual disturbances? Is the patient experiencing any gastrointestinal problems, such as nausea, vomiting, or abdominal cramping? Is the patient reporting any chest pain or shortness of breath? Sample history. In a patient with known sickle cell disease, ask the following questions in addition to obtaining a sample history. Have you had a crisis before? When was the last time you had a crisis? How did your last crisis resolve? Have you had any illnesses, unusual amount of activity, or stress lately? Secondary assessment. The secondary assessment may be performed on scene, en route to the emergency department, or not at all. This will depend on transport time and the patient's condition. Physical examinations. Next, systematically examine the patient, focusing on major joints at which cells congregate, and obtain your patient's baseline vital signs. Evaluate and document mental status using the AVPU scale. Vital signs. Obtain a complete set of vital signs, including a measurement of the patient's oxygen saturation level. In patients experiencing a sickle cell crisis, respirations are normal to rapid, pulse is weak and rapid, and skin is typically pale and clammy with a low blood pressure. Monitoring devices. Use pulse oximetry if available. However, keep in mind that the oxygen saturation reading you obtain may be inaccurate as a result of the patient's anemic state. Reassessment. It is important to reassess the patient frequently to determine if there have been changes in his or her condition. For example, are there changes in the patient's mental status? Are the ABCs still intact? How is the patient responding to the interventions performed? Should you adjust or change the interventions? In many patients, you will note marked improvement with appropriate treatment. Document each assessment, your findings, the time of the interventions, and any changes in the patient's condition. Interventions. Supplemental oxygen should be administered via non-rebreathing mask at 12 to 15 liters per minute in an attempt to hypersaturate the remaining hemoglobin and increase the level of perfusion that has been decreased by the sickled cells or hemophilia. Once arriving at the hospital, care for sickle cell patients can include analgesics for pain, penicillin to prevent infection, IV fluid for hydration, and, depending on the severity of the crisis, a blood transfusion. Distinguishing a true sickle cell crisis from other nonspecific causes of pain can be difficult. In these situations, perform a thorough assessment and contact the hospital to help sort out the signs and symptoms. The hospital should be a resource for you to help problem-solve situations and provide guidance on how to manage your patient. Hospital care for a patient with hemophilia may include IV therapy to treat hypotension and a transfusion or plasma. Analgesics may also be appropriate. Communication and documentation. Communication with hospital staff is important for continuity of care. Hospital personnel need to be informed about the patient's history, the present situation, your assessment findings, and your interventions and their results. Your run report is the only legal document you have to say that appropriate care was provided. Document clearly your assessment findings as the basis for your treatment. Follow your local protocols for patients who refuse treatment or transport. Emergency medical care for hematologic disorders. Emergency care for patients with hematologic disorders is mainly supportive and symptomatic. Patients showing signs of inadequate breathing or altered mental status should receive high-flow oxygen at 12 to 15 liters per minute via non-rebreathing mask and should be placed in a position of comfort and transported rapidly to the hospital.